Episode 9, Learning from History. I'm Peter Wilkinson, and the Future of Journalism is a series presented by the Alliance for Journalists' Freedom in Australia. We say, how can we plan about the future without knowing where we should be heading? It's been argued that the pace of change is now so fast that in many areas, what we can learn from history about the future is limited. Not so with the future of journalism, says Hugh Rimmington. He's been an award-winning TV reporter, a foreign correspondent, author, and news anchor, including for CNN in the USA, and he's currently National Affairs Editor at Network 10. Relevant to us, though, he's an amateur historian, and so argues there's a lot to be learnt about what's ahead by looking back. So, Hugh, how would you like to see journalism in 15 to 20 years?
Well, how I'd like to see journalism in 15 to 20 years is nothing like what I think it might appear to be in 15 to 20 years. Obviously, I'd like to see robust journalism, well-funded by sources that enable it to keep its independence with, thriving and avid reporters and editors, you know, uncovering the information that a society needs on which to make the key decisions for its own future, while also having the sports results. I think where journalism is going over the next 15 to 20 years is fairly bleak. And I don't think we should be too surprised by that, because I think what we have imagined journalism to be, as if it's some kind of immutable part of a modern society, really only has, in historical terms, had a very brief period of existence. It came and now it is going, and I don't think we'll see the like of it again.
So in television terms anyway, journalism's heyday lasted really from the mid-70s through to the end of the last century. Journalism in newspapers was strong before that. When you talk about journalism history being very brief, what do you mean?
Well, I think fundamentally, journalism is news, which is the passing around of information that is of importance to a community. Fundamentally, that's what it is. And something that wouldn't have had the name journalism has existed from the very first times that humans organized themselves politically. And you can see in the rise of the city-states, if you go back to Athens, the people who would deliver news. Homer, to a certain degree, was reciting an account of a battle of enormous importance and historical weight to the people of his time. And it was an oral tradition that was sustained. So we understand from the classical scholars, you can see people like Pericles, a great Athenian statesman, for example, would give his speeches. They'd be recorded by people at the time so that people who weren't there would be able to understand what was said. And then that would be passed on. There was a kind of a journalism happening there. But there was nothing like journalism as we understand it. It wasn't funded. It simply went along. And if you look at human history down through the last couple of thousand years, people were, broadly speaking, in Western civilization illiterate unless they were within the church or in the very tiny elites. And then with the Age of Enlightenment, you started to have science and the distribution of science aided by the printing press, so that the church was being challenged as being the sole source of, if you like, written information and an understanding of the world. If you look at the time of the American Revolutionary War, we're talking about the 1770s, there was no journalism as we would understand it. There were pamphlets. They were the powerful ways in which ideas about revolution, ideas about what change that was taking place in the American colony were essentially distributed. At the same time, there were sheets that conducted advertising, often the shipping news, what ships had arrived, what stuff had come in, rush on down there if you want to buy silks or whatever it might have been. And then the genius was to put the two things together, to attach the advertising and the shipping news that people were willing to pay for to the ideas of the news that went around. So that by the time we got to the American Civil War in the 1860s, you had essentially the model or by that stage in place that drove journalism through for the next 150 odd years. Initially, the early newspapers had the advertising still on the front and the news at the back. Then people realized, no, stick it the other way around. People want to read what's going on. And journalism began. And then that allowed public trust. It allowed journalism to become this almost quite pompous organization to take place, which believed it had a public duty of to truth, to giving two sides of a story, to observing the law, and the grand days of journalism arose and newspapers reached their height. Now, what happened with the digital age was that was split asunder and will never come back.
So what do you see as the potential for the future? The more immediate future, how do you see us getting through this bleak period where journalism is starved of money?
I don't think there is any getting through this bleak period, because there's been all kinds of ways to try to figure out a financial model. There is none that has been particularly lasting. There have been philanthropic models where people just put up money for journalism, but in the end, sooner or later, you run out of other people's money, as Margaret Thatcher famously said. So unless you've got a solid economic base for what you're doing, it cannot last.
So there's a line of thinking, and we've had people speaking about it on the Future of Journalism series, that the internet is tailor-made for very inexpensive journalism, that you can build a publication on almost no money on the internet, and as long as you can employ a couple of journalists, you can publish. So the funding model has completely changed. And you're right, it doesn't favour the big television stations, but it does favour small niche publications, more like little business publications or sporting publications or consumer publications. So do you think that might be the future?
Well, I think it'll be the future for some, but for the most part, it's far easier to talk than it is to listen. And there are a lot of voices talking, not many making any money out of it. And it is this fractious splitting, all these myriad different realities that people are pushing out through the digital, weapons that they have available to them, that is really changing society in really profound ways.
So that gets to two points. One is the polarization of the noise that you're talking about, and the other is activist journalism. What are your thoughts on the rise of activist journalism?
It's interesting you say polarization. I think we've moved beyond polarization. Polarization suggests two poles. We're really now inhabiting a multiverse, and this is where there are so many points of view being shouted across the ether, the digital ether, where people are not listening to each other. That's quite clear. We saw that in the United States. I was over there for the election coverage. I watched with interest the QAnon conspiracy theory, for example, that developed, which is completely and utterly barking insane. Europe has a more recent direct experience of extreme far right movements, Nazism, obviously, fascism in Italy and in Spain. So there is perhaps a greater level of caution, a greater institutional caution about these sorts of things. You know, the scars are not so well healed, I suppose, that people want to buy all this stuff. Whereas in the United States, there seems to be a kind of a glee in knowing something that no one else, you know, that the elites, the hated elites, say is rubbish. That just seems to put more fuel on the fire. Could it come to Australia? Yes. I think one thing which happens in Australia is the unexpected glory of our voting system is that compulsory voting, which in terms of liberal theory I oppose, has been a tremendous success for us, because it means that our political leaders and potential political leaders know they can only win if they can appeal to the center, to the somewhat disinterested or uninterested center. They don't have to go to the extremes to build up a base. And that gives us some buffer against the madness that we see elsewhere. Because the other thing that's happened in the media is, back before the digital age, the newspapers, Channel 9 that I used to work for, all the other TV networks were trying to own the center. They tried to own the center because that's where the mass population was and that's where the most money was. So they were motivated to essentially be centrist in their outlook. With that disappearing, so that you in fact have a financial and economic incentive to to inhabit and own the extremes. We've seen that with Fox, for example, in the US, and others have tried to get to outfox Fox, InfoWars and others that are completely barking insane. You know, if you own a fringe group, then you benefit financially for it. And that splitting away from the center has done great damage, I think, to, you know, to the nation, to democracy, to liberal democracies, and potentially will get worse in the decades ahead.
So there is the rise of activist journalism. So people who are passionate about a cause and then extend into writing about it under the guise of journalism. What are your thoughts on that, the pros and cons?
Well, I've got no problem with activist journalism, people writing, you know, considered views as to, you know, a whole bunch of things. There are obviously, you know, it becomes deeply problematic when that activist journalism, so-called, becomes essentially movements that seek to destroy the rights of others. And whether it's on the far right, whether it's from religious extremist groups, whether in some cases it comes from a kind of an anarcho-leftist model as well. And one of the things that we're seeing is it doesn't go to the business of writing, you know, trying to make an argument from one side or the other to convince other people, but really this effort of deplatforming people. You know, the shortest way to make a fuss is to take people off their platforms, to essentially hound people out of the digital space. You know, there's a lot of argument this comes from the left, that it comes from feminist movements. But we shouldn't forget that, you know, Andrew Bolt, when he was caught out by the Racial Discrimination Act, was seeking effectively to deplatform a series of people who identified rightly as Aboriginal people but were pale skinned, and his argument essentially was to the effect that they didn't have a right to speak because they were too pale to speak as Aboriginal people. He was essentially attempting to deplatform them, and then cried like hell when the courts found that he'd breached the Racial Discrimination Act, and they essentially to a degree deplatformed him on that point but not on his broader points.
Isn't the issue with activist journalism is people only present what they're passionate about, so that objectivity goes, and the concept of factual reporting and reporting both sides of the story vanishes?
Well, yes. I mean, in a sense, if you're reporting all sides of a story, is it really activism journalism or is it traditional journalism? Most people who are occupying the space, given that they must be doing it for you know, to feed their own passions or for an outlet for their own passions, because they're not going to make a lot of money out of it. They've usually got some other source of income. So, you know, activist journalism itself is a little bit problematic as a concept. Are they activists or are they journalists? If the old sort of public trust concept of journalism as being something which reflects all sides to an argument, gives people a right of reply, well, that's not what you see on the really activist areas. They're about putting out their case. They're motivated to make their case. We see it in environmental movements around climate change. You know, we see it in a whole bunch of areas where people work very hard to build an argument
and to sell an argument.
And then
that doesn't worry you?
There's somewhere between journalism and propagandists. Sometimes they're well beyond propagandists. No, it doesn't worry me in the sense that it's inevitable. It makes no difference whether it worries me or not. It's going to happen. So what troubles me is that there is no longer, I know it's ridiculous to hark back to the past, but there's no longer the sense that once existed. It existed in the 1980s, where virtually every citizen in Australia at 6 o'clock sat down to watch either one of two news bulletins, you know, in which a middle-aged man would intone to them the events that had happened of that day. And there'd be general common agreement that those were important matters that they could then move forward on. And if they were going to disagree, there was some understanding of common ground. Now, all of that, people would say, you know, good riddance to bad rubbish, but all of that is completely gone. So what we've now got is people who can't bear to hear points of view that don't align with their own. And the loss of that centralizing instinct is, I think, somewhat damaging. My father, who lived under German occupation in the Second World War, hammered into me as a young man, as a boy, he said, the best ideas will not be found at the extremes. And really what he's kind of saying is that sometimes there are some radical ideas which over time appear less radical, but at the same time, things only become a good idea if they become a good idea to a majority. So that whatever it is, you could be talking about same-sex marriage. It was considered a nonsensical, weird heresy 20 or 30 years ago, and then it became law because the country had moved, a population had moved. So it doesn't really matter where the idea comes from, but at some stage, we need to have a point at which we come together and kind of listen to each other and say, well, that's cool. I can live with that. You can, okay, fine. Let's move on with it. You know, we've got an issue about a voice to the parliament from Indigenous people, from First Australian people. We don't even have a base to start to have that conversation because everyone's barking in their own small rooms. And that trend is really only just getting underway. It's going to get more and more like that, I suspect, in the years ahead.
Hugh, it's been fascinating to talk to you on the future of journalism. Really appreciate it, and thank you very much.
Great to talk to you, Peter.